This edition of The Stack was first broadcast on the 27th of December 2014 on Monocle 24. Sporting journals that sell by the million, kiosks and counters filled to bursting point. A precious paper keepsake, or celebrity rags ready for pulping. Newspaper designs and redesigns from broadsheet to Berliner. New launches and magazine milestones from Paris, Sydney and beyond. A year of personalities, profiles and predictions from the world of print on The Stack. On this very special edition of The Stack, we look back at the year that was 2014 by taking various choice morsels from your favourite programme, the only radio show of its kind. What a year it was, when many would have you believe that print was dead. On The Stack, we could only find evidence that told us precisely the opposite. From some of the industry's most celebrated designers, typographers, editors and creators, we get the lowdown here on The Stack. From our friend and magazine guru, Penny Martin.
There's fashion studies with women who aren't models, let's say. And that's always a really tricky thing to pull off. So we've been working on that for quite a while and it feels quite fun, a study, a sort of semiotic study of posing.
Two in-flight magazine experts in Canada.
In this industry, in the industry of in-flight, so many publishers say, you know, it's a brilliant business because we've got this captive audience. And we've always said the captive audience never has existed. As long as you've walked onto a plane with a briefcase, you were never captive to any airline's publication.
To a local hero who really knows his shelves.
Because of the kind of mix that has come into the area over the last 5-10 years, we have concentrated more and more on actually getting unusual and independent titles.
All that and many more tasty snippets from the last year of The Stack, Monocle 24's dedicated print industry review and analysis programme. Hello and welcome to episode 122 of The Stack, Monocle's weekly roundup of great print. This is a special, I might call it collector's edition of the programme, where we're hearing some of the best of what the year just gone had to offer. It's been an eventful year, both inside and outside Midori House. Magazines and journals that are a treat to hold and flick through, but we've also looked at a whole spectrum of printed material and the people who busy themselves filling all those beautiful pages. The newspaper redesign is something that's seen more and more as media groups vie for those remaining print-inclined readers. And so many newspapers seem to be on a constant campaign to reinvent the way their products look and feel. We took stock with a man who's been at the forefront of this trend of newspaper reinvention. Designer Mark Porter was creative director of The Guardian, where some 10 years ago he radically altered the format and style of the paper, something which inspired many redesigns the world over. Here, Mark reflects on that famous redesign.
There was a lot of pressure because it was a big project and The Guardian already had a very distinguished design history. You know, there'd been a classic redesign in 1988 by David Hillman of Pentagram, and that really did change the way people looked at newspaper design. So I had all that pressure on me, knowing that in the past great work had been done. I also came from a Guardian reading household. You know, my father was a Guardian reader, so I had all that pressure on me too. So I knew it was a big job, but I didn't really have an awareness of the influence it would have in the outside world once it was done. You know, you can't think too far ahead on these projects. You have to keep your head down, do the best job you can and not worry too much about what people might think of it in the future.
Even if it's your own household thinking about it.
Well, I was aware that my father would have a very critical judgment.
But tell me, interesting, you mentioned that Pentagram one from the 80s, real sort of iconic work. What's your sort of approach to that? Do you acknowledge that and feed off that and work off those designs? If you're sort of following something like that that was so significant and made such impact, or do you try and, to an extent, start with a blank canvas? What's your strategy?
Well, the strategy for the business was definitely to try and start with a blank canvas, to kind of forget everything that had gone before. But as a graphic designer, you know, I was very aware of the influence of that design. And it brought in certain things that seemed to me to be part of the visual character of The Guardian. So it was very clearly based on that kind of Swiss European modernist range left approach. So we kept that. We kept the kind of way of using space, you know, confining spaces in certain areas and having other areas very dense. So some graphic elements of it we were able to carry through, but we did want the new design to look completely different. And the theory, at least, was that we would strip everything back down to the basics and completely reinvent it. And really, the whole point of doing a project like this as a designer is that you try and do something very different from what's been done before because, you know, it's been done so well. There's no point in trying to kind of do something in the same vein.
No tweaking around the edges. And what about the kind of format design? Because a lot was made in this country about the sort of Berliner format, call it what you will. Is that liberating to work when you've got a sort of literally a new template? Or do you find it is rather constricting? Because obviously there are literal restrictions on what you're doing. How did that sort of bring to bear on the overall redesign?
Well, Alan Rusbridger, the editor, was very keen on the Berliner. He'd always been a big fan of Le Monde and the Swiss papers, so he'd always been a Berliner lover. We came very close to doing a tabloid because it would have been very quick and easy. We could have used the same printing presses. But Alan wanted to do a Berliner so much that we had to build a new printing factory, which took 2 years. As it happens, the Berliner is a wonderful format because, you know, the tabloid is great in some respects. You can get a lot of drama on that small page, but you can only accommodate 2 or 3 stories on a page. The broadsheet, you can get a lot of stories on a page, 7, 8 stories, and you can do a story on a single page. When you do a story on a double page, it's almost too much in a broadsheet. The eye can't sort of take it all in. So the great thing about the Berliner is that you can do a bit of both. You can have all the excitement of a tabloid design, but you can do stories on a double page spread. And if you want to, you can get 6 or 7 stories on a page. So it gives you a lot of flexibility and it allows you to play more with the kind of rhythm and the pace and have a few more surprises in there than either of the other formats really do.
That was Mark Porter speaking to me in the spring. Now, from design layout to typography, Neville Brody established his reputation working with record labels, magazines, and a range of international clients from Apple to Dom Perignon. Brash launches such as that of Trendsetting the Face in 1981 and later Arena, as well as radical redesigns such as that for The Times, have given Brody an astonishing reputation amongst the design world. Never one to rest on his laurels, Neville founded design agency Research Studios in 1994 and went on to redesign the new logo for the BBC and made his mark on the visual language of Hollywood too through work for clients such as Paramount Studios. Neville is also an academic and is the current head of communications at London's Royal College of Art. Tyler Brulé sat down with Neville and began by looking back to London's mag culture some 30 years ago.
Back in the 80s. The only place you could buy international magazines was on Old Compton Street. That was it.
Yeah.
And you would have to go there, seek it out. And it was just like a traditional newsagent's, but they had every magazine in the world, and it was the most amazing space. And you didn't go in because you'd bankrupt yourself for the next month. Nowadays, they're much more available, so they're widely distributed, but to less outlets. Mm. So you'll find that the few outlets that are not supermarkets tend to sell all the international magazines. And anywhere you go in the world, in fact, I find English magazines or British magazines or English language magazines easier to buy in Tokyo.
Absolutely.
Or San Francisco.
Yeah.
That you can't find on the streets here. So there's this kind of strange flip that's going on. At the time, international magazines, when we were beginning the face, were not particularly inspirational. There wasn't that much around. And that quickly flipped. So, you know, like the Père Louis or Italian Vogue or stuff tended to then become sources of inspiration for other areas like beauty. I mean, we didn't understand that stuff. And then in New York, you had this different kind of underground art culture. So we didn't understand that stuff. So all of this stuff kind of became this potpourri of melting pot of influences. But what the UK did was it managed to take that and turn that into a bold statement. Pulling all of those things together, there isn't the same sense of, I guess, centres where those things can happen now. I mean, Monocle's doing a grand job, of course. I know that the kind of the feel of Monocle is pretty much aligned to what an online experience might be, where you kind of dip in, grab certain stories. There's an attention deficit problem so that the length of story gets shorter, etc. So we're used to this kind of browsing, and then you've where Monocle started, I remember the story's been much longer, and now they're more kind of bite-sized. So it's about fitting in with the lifestyle. And the influences in Monocle are worldwide. I mean, this is almost a newsagent on Old Compton Street in itself, where you pull all these things together. So it's not so much about the Face magazine, which was celebrating London culture, UK culture, and then broadcasting it to the world. It's kind of flipped now, and it's about, I guess, collectors that go out and spot interesting things and then bring them back. So we're back to a kind of cultural safari model.
Does London feel more international or more of a beacon now versus then? And I think back to the role that the face had and certainly early on in Arena, where you would see, and certainly that relationship, and you mentioned Tokyo, the relationship that existed between London and Tokyo then, just the this incredible, you know, the kids that you would see coming from Japan, and maybe they were easier to spot then, I don't know, but I got that sense then that, you know, all eyes were on the city, and because it was London, and yes, the face became more international as it grew up, etc., but it was, the story was here.
Well, there was a tribalism, and there were different tribes, not like kind of online groups, which are very different, but there was a tribalism, and tribes connected and yet identified themselves. And because there was a chance for things to, I guess, incubate and gestate and develop before they were known by the public, things had more depth when you touched them. Nowadays, things grow up in public. So, you know, we've just had this great exciting new band play with a new music thing, and then it's tweeted, and then 2 weeks later everyone knows about it, and a week later it's dead. See, what happened is that there's a homogenization. As the pool gets bigger, the need to flatten it out gets bigger. So Starbucks is the same in every country, and what they do is they tend to replace local flavor. Because for Starbucks, you can't afford to have a million different possibilities. You have to flatten it, otherwise you can't distribute successfully. It's not an economic model. So the idea of all of this, social media, internationalization, globalization, it becomes kind of generic, because any other model you can't distribute successfully financially. So what happens then is people need to find these other outlets for these individual things. Magazines are one of the few things that remain. And then people that will self-publish their own music, for instance, is one of those spaces. So the memo's gone out that individualism should be supported, but the people that are in power, to which the memos have gone to, have defined this as their new space that they need to own. So it's somehow it's a kind of guise of individualism.
Using his vast breadth of experience to reflect on the magazine culture past and present, that was Neville Brody there with Tyler Brulé. You're listening to The Stack on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, where I'm taking you through some of the best from the show in 2014. With its iconic pink pages, its ubiquitous daily presence in the bars and cafes of a football-mad nation, the Gazzetta dello Sport is a sport newspaper like no other. With a circulation of around 400,000, it's also one of Europe's most read dailies. As the FIFA World Cup heated up in June and stories came in from Brazil, our man in Milan, Ivan Carvalho, went to the Gazzetta offices to see the action for himself.
To say Italians love football is an understatement. Three national sports dailies put out editions each day to satisfy locals' appetites for the game. Leading the way is La Gazzetta dello Sport. Founded in 1896, it's the nation's most widely read newspaper. It stands out not only for the pink paper it is printed on, but the creative ways it covers every facet of football. While it features all sports, it has a team of 45 journalists assigned to follow football to feed a public hungry for news. Despite competition from TV, radio, and the web, Gazzetta has a loyal following, particularly those keen to catch up on the pagelle, a rating system ranking a player's performance during a match, and whose score has repercussions off the pitch. Gazzetta staff writer Luca Tadelli.
In the last 20 years, our way to work has changed even because of the fantasy football. That it's another thing Italians are obsessed of. So it changed because I think we are selling many copies, even because the people want to see the player ratings the day after the game, and the days before they want to see the lineups, because of course you bought some players and you want to know if your player is playing that game or not.
Given today's 24-hour news cycle, players on Twitter, and websites detailing gossip in the transfer market, Gazzetta's editors keep a step ahead of today's football-savvy public by looking for new ways to speak intelligently about the sport. Alex Frozio is an editor on the paper's football desk.
I think, first of all, we have to give something they can't find immediately. So let's make an example. If you watch a football match, everybody knows the result. So you have to give to the reader something more. What we changed is trying to give a tactical analysis of every player. For example, we introduce this column, which is called the analysis. Usually we analyze two players, how they played, their statistics, just like the Billy Bean story, you know, with passes complete and dribblings and take-ons. And that's something that you can't find actually on the internet, maybe also on TV, because you don't have the time to watch these kind of things. On the newspaper, you can stay there, read it, take your time, and this helps, I think, to understand what really happened.
Debate about what happened during a match is overheard everywhere in Italy. But Ferozio says the most popular place to catch up on Gazzetta is at the cafe.
Yeah, La Gazzetta dello Sport is a tradition in Italy. It's a kind of way to start the day. In fact, we are in almost every bar in Italy. We sell, I think, something like 70,000 copies every day in bars. You know, in Italy we have so many bars, so in almost every bar we have La Gazzetta, so you drink a coffee, read the newspaper. It's a tradition.
At Milan Cafe Moscova 15, owner Giuseppe Negozio testifies to Gazzetta's popularity. His cafe's well-worn copy sits between patrons discussing Italy's World Cup chances.
Every morning we have many regulars that come here to read La Gazzetta, and they have a lot of fun commentating on it together. It's really a very Italian habit to commentate on sport at the bar every morning, and particularly with La Gazzetta. In a very fond way, we Italians also call the paper the pink, because it's been a part of the ritual of Italian breakfast for many, many years, especially on Mondays, when people want to know the results of the matches over the weekend.
With the Italian team off to a good start in Brazil, Gazzetta's editors hope for a repeat of 2006 triumph in Berlin, which saw the paper sell over 2.5 million copies following the final. For Monaco, in Milan, I'm Ivan Carvalho.
From Milan to another style capital, Paris. American magazine Holiday was in its heyday in the 1940s and 50s, but went out of business a few decades ago. A French duo have brought the publication back to life, and since early 2014, it's been back on the shelves at newsstands right around the globe. Maintaining some of the typeface and layout of decades past, and staying true to the original concept of employing top writers and photographers, Holiday claims to show the world in a way that no other magazine does. Monocle's Paris correspondent Tom Burgess-Watson went to meet the magazine's editor-in-chief Marc Boget in the baking sun at a cafe in the heart of the French capital.
Tu es comme le vent qui fait chanter les violons et emporte au loin le parfum des roses.
Caramel, bonbon et chocolat.
We are between vintage and modern. We didn't choose to totally forget about the past or to copy it. We just did something in between because we both like... Me and Franck, the artistic director, Franck Durand, we both like vintage images. So we use old images already used by Holiday magazine in the 50s. And we also produce new images. We think the mix makes it interesting and new in a way.
Do you think there's much of a market for a Holiday magazine? There's quite a lot of them on the shelves as it is. And, you know, so many of these sorts of magazines, even ones that are dealing in the high-end holiday market, they have applications, you know, you can read them on your tablet and so on. Is there a market in your opinion?
Well, we didn't think about it when launching magazine. I and Frank don't think about will there be a market for what we'll be doing. We think, will we enjoy doing it? That's what we thought when we started thinking about Holiday. But I think when you do something excellent, there is always a market. That's what we try to do. I don't believe that the magazines are dead, not at all. The bad magazines maybe are dead, but the good ones will live again. People will still enjoy have something in their hand, have a beautiful paper, something they can keep, something they can put on their table. I believe that you have to be better than what you can get for free on the internet, that's for sure.
Okay, so issue one came out in April. Tell us a little bit about what the theme of the first issue was. What were you trying to cover?
So the first issue was dedicated to 69, the year 69, because there is something hedonist about Holiday magazine.
So what places did you visit for that first edition in order to capture the essence of the year 1969?
We went to many places, but we spent a lot of time in Ibiza in the winter. We had a writer called Arthur Dreyfus, which is with one of the main young writers in France, going to this place for a week. He basically lost himself in Ibiza, and he tells us about what is this place in the winter when there is no party, when there is no tourist. And if I think he gave an idea of what the 69 spirit is and why it was so big in Ibiza, why this island has become such a synonym of partying.
And you bought the rights to this magazine because it had been dormant for all these years. Tell us a little bit about the history of Holiday Magazine and how and why this idea came to you to buy the rights and how it works.
Holiday was one of the most prestigious magazines in the 50s. It launched at a time when America was going very well in terms of economy. It was after the war. The economics were going up and traveling was getting more and more democratic. People would travel. So to match that new trend, Holiday was created. After a few years of average sales, they hired a new chief editor. And that guy decided that he would only have writers, you know, prestigious, well-known writers going to places and telling of the places. He put the bar very high in terms of writing. The artistic director also was very demanding to photographers. They had pictures by Robert Capa, for instance. We are very happy that the chief editor of the original Holiday magazine liked our first issue. He's quite old nowadays, but he saw the magazine. We sent it to him, and he, through his daughter, he told us that he was very proud to see Holiday living again, that he thought we did a great job. It was quite good for us.
Caramel, bonbon et chocolat.
Si tu n'existais pas déjà, je t'inventerais.
Monocle's Paris correspondent Tom Burgess-Watson there, speaking to Holiday's editor-in-chief Marc Boget, back in a sweltering summer. I'm Tom Edwards, and I'm taking you on a special guided tour of the best of the stack from the last 12 months. Now, if you happen to be flying out of London en route to your holiday destination, would rather not chance the magazine offering at Heathrow or Gatwick, we can recommend a far better shop to sustain all your print appetites. Just around the corner from Midori House and two doors down from the Monocle Cafe, 3G News has become a goldmine of high-quality publications. Still a fully functioning newsagents offering convenience to the community and catering to some very niche customers in the same breath, owner and manager Sandeep Sriji spoke to our producer, David Pleasant, from behind the till.
331.
Thank you.
Would you like a bag
at all? It's okay. I'm Sandeep. We are standing in Chilton Street, one of the main streets in Marylebone, a nice quaint street, and had the business for over 30 years now. Started off pretty much as a general news agent, but we've kind of developed more of the magazine, the print side of it. We work a lot with ad agencies and graphic and media companies. And because of the kind of mix that has come into the area over the last 5-10 years, we have concentrated more and more on actually getting unusual and independent titles and gone a bit away from the sort of run-of-the-mill titles that are available in most newsagents.
That process, it's noticeable. I mean, every time we come in, we see kind of new titles, up-and-coming things that even we haven't heard of. How does it work? Do people approach you? You say you work with advertising agencies. How are you getting your name out, and how are people hearing about you, and how are you going about getting this fantastic spread?
Well, I think the idea that we've been around for 30 years, that obviously makes a difference. One same business being around creates a kind of credibility and also what you're trying to do as a company. Apart from that, people come to us and we also start looking for titles.
Sorry, were you looking for anything?
Yeah, bridal magazines.
Bridal?
No, I'm just seeing them here. Yes. Thanks.
Sure.
So what have you bought there, if I can?
I've got two bridal magazines, just recently got engaged.
Congratulations.
So thank you.
So what have you gone for?
On my bridal skills now. You and Your Wedding, no idea about that one. And Vogue Esposa. Italian.
Okay. Well, happy reading.
Yeah, thank you.
And another thing that intrigues me is how you're keeping what is a newsagent business going as well. As we've noticed, people coming in and out, they might want to buy their cigarettes or perhaps something less highbrow, let's say, like some of the glossies, the weeklies. Yeah. There's Heat, OK, Hello, all the rest of it. So the kind of typical newsagent fare.
Yes.
You're still determined to kind of keep those two services to the community. Is that very much part of what you're doing?
I think it is, because we started off as a newsagent for the community, and the community does support us. So there's no reason why we would take that away. But within that, if we can extend what we are doing in a certain way, because these titles really are very, very dead now off the shelves.
So we're talking about the glossies, the commercial weeklies and so on.
Yes. I mean, if you go onto iPad or anything, most of these are available free of charge to download and read. And these are not something that somebody's going to see and keep unless they've got an article about themselves in it or something. But otherwise, it's a throwaway thing. And I think we have to keep it available. And also, because we supply ad agencies who are obviously advertising in these titles, then we need to carry it to supply them so we get some extra copies of the shelves. And from time to time, you'll run out of Hello, you might run out of Grazia, depends what's in it.
That was our Stack producer, David Pleasant, speaking to our neighbour, Sandeep Sriji. In September, we embarked on the relatively short journey to host the Stack from across the Channel, live in Paris. From there, I caught up with Tom Burgess-Watson, our correspondent in the city, to discuss some magazines of note.
Yeah, well, there's something quite nice about going to the newsstand in Paris, is that when you talk to the vendor at the kiosk, you actually get the impression they know what they're talking about. They've actually read all the editions, and he actually seemed very well read indeed. He was talking to me about the front cover of Courrier International, which is a very good read indeed. It's a sort of summary of what the world press is saying, translated back into French. They're leading with this front cover story, Destination Jihad. And what they've got is this picture of a backpack with a map and a Kalashnikov next to it, a mobile phone, and a British passport poking out of the pocket on that backpack, implying that the jihadists who have gone out to fight in Iraq and Syria would appear come from Britain. And yet inside they've got this story which they've taken out of La Repubblica, the Italian newspaper, which says that more than 700 jihadists who are engaged in fighting in Syria are originally from France, but it's a roughly double the number that have come from the UK according to their own statistics. So it's interesting that they chose to go with a British passport. But what's good about this magazine is it gives you a flavour of what's being discussed in the world news.
Well, let's go from the sort of sublime of the French publishing landscape and end on maybe the ridiculous. The resurgence, is it too early to say the resurgence of an old favourite, what should we call it, gentleman's special interest title? Tom, tell us a little bit more about Louis, which you have here.
This is edition number 10 of the reborn Louis magazine, which is a boys magazine. And we've talked about it on Monocle and we've talked about it on the Stack before, because it is a blokes magazine with quite a lot more testosterone than perhaps plenty of others. It's got the usual mix of watch and fast car reviews, a bit of fashion. The models modeling the clothes that us guys might want to go out and buy are quite a lot more robust than perhaps a lot of the models in a lot of other fashion magazines, and lots of rather suggestive photographs of women as well, not wearing a huge amount. So that's sort of the trademark of Louis magazine. It always was, back in the day when it was perhaps in its heyday in the 70s. A little racy, I must say, Tom.
That was our Paris correspondent, the always busy Tom Burgess-Watson again, talking to me in Paris, where we were looking at some of the best magazines in the kiosks there. Stay tuned to this very special edition of The Stack. Up next, we're looking at one of our favourite titles. We're leafing through The Gentlewoman next.
Christmas is fast coming upon us. Now's the time to wrap up warm in the wind, snuggle up on the couch, or jet off to new destinations. Our entire range of products and collaborations come from makers that are proud to show their provenance. From ESK knitwear and Anderson jackets, to Porter weekend bags and luxury Beg & Co. home blankets. The Monocle shop has everything you need to find the perfect gift this Christmas. Available in-store and online at monocle.com/shop. Monocle Films visits a trio of women's wear designers in London, Brussels and Copenhagen, daring women to dress in a different way.
There's two different markets in a way. There's like the fashion market, which is really unappealing to me. And then there's the clothing market, which is much more appealing and making good quality products.
Women's Wear Heroes, our latest Monocle briefing film, now playing in the film section on monocle.com.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to The Stack with me, Tom Edwards, where I'm taking you through some of the best of what the year just gone had to offer. Amongst the hundreds of titles that I've reviewed and discussed over the course of a year's worth of The Stack, one magazine always seems to crop up, mentioned again and again. It's become a bit of a classic in terms of design, photography and editorial content. The Gentlewoman is only released twice per year, but has enough packed into each issue to keep us aficionados engaged. Back in episode 107 of the show in September, I spoke to this fine publication's editor, Penny Martin, who here tells me about their 10th issue, the Autumn and Winter edition.
Ooh, it's big. It's packed with women. On the cover is Robin, the Swedish musician, pop a phenomenon, who we've been after for a long time, which is feels like cause for celebration. And Marlene Duma, Kirsty Young of Desert Island Discs, Vanessa Grigoriadis, who's the writer who penned the famous Gwyneth Paltrow profile that we'll never read in Vanity Fair. Chitozie Abe, who's of Sakai, the fashion brand. And then lots of kind of chatty conversations with a lot of actresses. We've got Kirsten Week, also Maddie Hill from EastEnders, which has been fantastic, and Stacey Martin. Those are all the kind of big chats. And then there's kind of quite a very, quite a vivacious fashion section. A mixture of, God, I hate the word real women, but there's fashion studies with women who aren't models, let's say. And that's always a really tricky thing to pull off. So we've been working on that for quite a while and it feels quite fun. A study, a sort of semiotic study of posing. all the usual sort of neurotic sort of fanatical perspectives on fashion that you'd expect of us.
Okay, well, we'll talk a bit more about that later. Just on Robin, obviously Robin was in, I think, the very first issue,
she was
is that
on
right?
A list. Yeah, sometimes do a kind of list of tips or a list of things to do with your hands or something like that. Well, she was in the first one of gifting tips, I think, which was in our first issue. And we've been sort of in touch. I met her by Skype doing an interview for Cost Magazine, which my colleagues at Fantastic Man produce, our company does. And I kind of knew I was going to fall in love with her because we had some friends in common and I'd heard a little bit about her, but it was just great. And I just knew that we needed to make more of our kind of exchange. So it was just a case of kind of waiting till we had the right balance. And it's great. You know, we had is she now 73-year-old fashion designer on our cover in Vivienne Westwood last time. So it's great to have a 35-year-old Swedish woman with a completely different universe and perspective. So, it's nice to get the balance going.
And that's the kind of variety, I guess, that your readership, the reason that they love the magazine. What about, just on the point of Robin, people say, never meet your heroes because it's a different. What about meeting your heroines? Is that, I sense that she's something of a heroine for you. Did she kind of live up to it? There was never a time when you thought, it's revealed something that, changes my perception of Robin as a performer, as a person.
There are some telltale things that you think, don't do that, during the course of an interview or the process of doing a profile, because it takes a long time, or at least you're in touch for a long time. There's one or two things that makes you think, don't be one of those women, And no, she displayed none of those characteristics. And in fact, we did a launch party the other night and she wouldn't get off the decks. And she was so friendly and kind of warm and forthcoming with all the people that attended. It was just the absolute antithesis of what you'd expect celebrity behaviour. But then, of course, she's never sort of positioned herself as a celebrity as such. And I think she sort of turned her back on, in the 90s, she absolutely could have been. When she did Show Me Love, she was massive and could have started, launching her own perfumes and so on. But, absolutely felt that wasn't for her. And I think what's interesting about her at the moment is she's got loads of releases this year and she's done this massive tour with Roy Scott. But I think she just feels that she's much more comfortable when she's kind of collaborating and doing lots of different projects with other people than feeling like she's kind of the sole author of her own kind of message. And I really enjoyed seeing that kind of generosity in real life, kind of meeting her on set. I mean, the morning after, I think it was Latitude, and she came off the set of Latitude. She must have got back to London about 4 o'clock that night, and she arrived on set and immediately was doing all her slow motion kind of signature dance moves. And it was just charming to see somebody so present and kind of luminous. Yeah, no, I defy you not to find her totally charming.
Penny Martin there, editor of Gentlewoman magazine, clearly charmed by the presence of Swedish musician Robin. Now we take to the skies and look at the onboard in-cabin offer when it comes to print. Once the proud publication for any self-respecting flag carrier, the in-flight magazine was the visual and editorial expression of a golden age of air travel. But what can travellers today expect to find inside that familiar netted seat pocket? Well, on the stack earlier this year, we took stock of the Mile High magazine sector with industry expert Raymond Girard from Sparfax, the content creators for in-flight magazines.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome aboard Delta Airlines Flight 2998, bound for Atlanta, Georgia, with continued service to Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport.
I usually have a soliloquy about the captive audience and how I believe that just makes us lazy. In this industry, in the industry of in-flight, so many publishers say, you know, it's a brilliant business because we've got this captive audience. And we've always said the captive audience never has existed. As long as you've walked onto a plane with a briefcase, you were never captive to any airline's publication. So you really had to work hard to make it better or good at the very least. And now that we're walking on with iPads and iPhones and all manner of personal entertainment devices, the customer is even less captive. So we try to bang out the captive audience thinking from our employees worldwide, because that just makes you think that you've got it easy and that you don't have to work hard to engage and entertain the customer. It's quite the opposite. You have to work harder.
All aisles, exits, and bulkhead areas should now be clear.
And if we can talk about sort of trends, what has happened to the in-flight magazine? Have you seen it diminish in importance and kind of the attention paid to it by publishers and airlines alike? What have you seen happen in the last, the last 5 years?
I'd say it all depends on the attitude that airlines have for communicating and connecting with their customers. Some publications have indeed diminished, I think those that have diminished are those who start taking the reader for granted and just sort of position them, you know, give them ads for hair replacement technology and all manner of content that nobody's really all that interested in. So airlines that see them as a repository for bland stuff are seeing them diminish in importance. They're seeing decreasing advertising sales with every issue almost. But there are airlines that do see it differently. Some airlines, you know, I'm thinking of Air Canada, even British Airways, Singapore Airlines, Vueling in Spain. Some airlines really see it as an opportunity to have a conversation with the customer and to present them content on their own terms.
And that's kind of a theme that we see across all manner of publications. That kind of lack of investment in a paper product has perhaps led to decline rather than any kind of lack of demand from the user. What do you think can be done to kind of reinvigorate the in-flight magazine? I mean, I'm always struck, and I think we're at Monocle, we're struck with a kind of the visual identity of airlines and how strong that history is, and how perhaps some airlines are missing a trick and not using what is a wonderful kind of design philosophy on a plate. Would you agree?
Absolutely. I think that, well, going back to the first part of your question, what can they do to reinvigorate the platform or the magazine? I think that airlines can celebrate the environment. So if you look at in-flight publications versus anything else the customer has in their briefcase, any other publication they can find in the gift shop at the airport or on the newsstand, I think there's a great opportunity to have a lot of fun with the environment and to do something that's really quite specific to what's going on, which is getting somebody from A to B in a metal tube at 35,000 feet.
Once again, welcome aboard Delta Flight 2928 to Atlanta, and thank you for flying Delta.
Raymond Girard from Sparfax there. Now from in-flight to very out and proud now on this best of edition of The Stack. From its inception in 2001, BUT set out to offer a finely tuned, carefully designed approach to alternative gay lifestyle stories. Far from just including full frontal nudity, BUT embellished and celebrated naked men and matched the images with in-depth, revelatory interviews. Editor Gert Jonkers and creative director Jop van Bennekom went on to launch Fantastic Man and then The Gentlewoman, titles which continue to shake the world of fashion publishing to its core. Forever Butt is the name of a book published to chart this Little Pink magazine's success, and David Pleasant sat down with Gert Jonkers, who spoke about what Butt means to him.
I think it's very much almost the basis of the things we still do with Fantastic Man and The Gentlewoman and the other projects that we do, is that, you know, it's basically just about the desire to meet people and sort of run into somebody and think like, wow, I would love to have a two-hour conversation with this person. Or sometimes you do have a two-hour conversation with somebody on a plane or in a train or in a bar. And it is always that desire. You know, maybe things we do in Fantastic Man are slightly more sophisticated, if you like, or we try out different formats, whereas BUT, you would, could say, was 90% just Q&A. But it's very dear to our hearts, and it's always that kind of reality that we keep, well, going back to, I wouldn't say, but it's just, you know, it's very much us, I think.
You've obviously had to choose, you make some decisions as to what, which people, which interviews, which images to feature. Were there kind of long nights with all the issues there in front of you, lots of printouts of all the pages of all the issues? How did it work?
There was maybe one long night with all the issues, and I think we all made a long list. Jop and I, and we worked with Carl, our assistant on the book. The three of us, we looked at it and sort of said like, okay, well, let's try this. And then we actually started making dummies or just like piles of paper. And we would sort of sift through the piles of paper and think like, that really doesn't work together. Or we were just looking for a form also. You know, the first book was anti-chronological, I would say. It sort of started with the most recent issue that we had out then, number 16 or 17, and went back to the first issue. This one's alphabetical because it just felt, I don't know. We toyed around a lot with what should the order be? What should the selection be? I mean, I think we had at some point a pile of 1,500 pages, and that couldn't possibly be a handy book. So we had to cut a lot, and we had to add in something again then because it didn't feel like the ultimate book yet. So, you know, it was a couple of weeks of going back to it and looking at it and being critical and being harsh and finishing it.
Here's the result.
We added a few pictures. I mean, the whole book is black and white, apart from some red pages. Wolfgang Tillmans wrote an introduction to the book, and Paul Flynn did an interview with Jop and I.
How interesting has it been for you to see, there's kind of two tangents going on. There's the independent publishing that's kind of exploded since BUT came on the scene. And also there's a change in the way that the bigger, let's say, glossy titles approach perhaps nudity, very frank conversations or attitudes to certain lifestyles or kind of different worlds, scenes. Do you kind of feel like BUT was really ahead of its game back then?
Yeah, we kind of look at it like that. I think people were honestly surprised. I mean, we were surprised that people were surprised about the frankness of the magazine and the directness. I mean, we just wanted to make a very real and direct magazine. And it was just funny to see how many people responded to it and how you could suddenly see newspapers do more Q&As. I mean, it's such a simple and proven format in a way that it's kind of weird that we forgot about it. So, I mean, I think that's just fascinating. But I do think it sparked a lot of people to do that again. And the whole zine thing, I mean, it's flattering and exciting to think that they came out somehow out of what BUT did. I mean, I hope we did that because it's a great movement. And, you know, if we could be responsible for that, that'd be amazing.
That was Gert Jonkers, editor of BUT, speaking to Stack's David Pleasant. In October, we produced a two-part focus on the state of the newsstand following the closure of one of our favourites, Greens, on Marylebone High Street here in London. Greens' demise is following a pretty depressing trend on the UK high street of independent retailers falling victim to tighter margins and real estate pressures brought about mainly from large multiple chains. No sector of independent retail feels this more than the humble newsagent. But what's caused this sorry state of affairs and how can it be changed? The publishers and distributors that ultimately feed printed products to the outlets must surely hold the answer. But how do these two sectors, in themselves very diverse, work together? Nowhere better to find out than at the annual Congress of DistriPress, which brought together the world's press distribution organisation on the shores of the Mediterranean in Cannes. Monocle's David Pleasant, never one to turn down a trip to the Côte d'Azur, was there.
As well as the value and ultimate cost of a magazine, the mood here at DistriPress in Cannes is that the industry needs to revalue itself. According to some, change in the market is no reason to mark down the value of good print.
I do worry that we are talking ourselves into retail reduction as the retailers make plans as they should do for the future. We saw on the other side some quite positive things coming out yesterday. People saying, well, actually, the new magazine launches are higher than they've ever been. Some of the magazines that you can see, the major magazines like Vogue and so on, had their biggest print editions ever. And we can see very strong brands like Monocle all doing very well in print. So I do believe that a certain amount of optimism is required here to also, not just for ourselves, but for our partners like the retailers. And then perhaps we won't get this erosion in retail space.
My name is Olga. I'm representing Lehepunkt and we're from Estonia. Print is profitable and what we are focusing on this year is efficiency. So our best knowledge about sales of exact places, exact type of POS, this is what we are using to promote, to increase, to support the sales. So last year we managed to keep the sales from dropping. And this year's target is actually the same. So this is what brings profit, efficiency of our work.
Diligent distributors and retailers that are happy to provide. But it seems that publishers too need to connect with the industry in a more engaging way. Overinvestment in digital tangents of their core product has not led to any profit, while many newsagents have been squeezed out. Finally, let's go back to DistriPress president Tony Jashanmal.
In our field, we've got to have people who will explain to you what this is and why you need it.
If someone has a kiosk or a small shop, you think they should know what they're selling, talk to their customer, talk to the clientele and more, and on the outlet level, on the shop front level.
Sure. You need somebody to come and tell you what is so great about their product. Tell your staff who's selling it. Encourage them. Take time for them. Take a day off for their training. This is what we lost in this field.
It's you can't expect a newsagent to know the inside of all his papers and each article, each writer. It's impossible, but maybe a feeling for them.
Exactly. A feeling for them. A feeling for what is it that you're trying to convey with that. What is the philosophy behind this particular magazine or whatever? How do you recognize the type of customer who actually reads this? He's a different type of people have a different way of being informed. How do you inform this person? The circulation people who know much more about what's happening in the market don't seem to have that much of an influence on the publisher.
Which is strange because you'd think that the publisher would be in the circulation business's kind of lap. They'd want to impress them in any way they could to get their product out there. Why are they not talking?
Basically, as far as I was concerned, it was the comfort of so many years of having that business just go on. I am very happy that the digital has come in, that it can wake people up.
So publishers, distributors, everyone should wake up a little bit and smell the coffee.
Yes, and not only that, and get out of this mode of the last couple of years thinking that this is the oncoming end of print.
A need for the industry to work together and communicate properly, all the way down the chain from the magazine publisher to the newsagent at the outlet. After the panic of a few years ago, the print industry, if you can call these diverse sectors that, is beginning to see that it needs to stick to what it does best, delivering its readers all the print they want in an efficient and customised way. It should also be using much more of its resources to provide for that choice, that moment of perusal and discovery that we all love. The alternative is probably the disappearance of the newsstand altogether. For Monocle, in Cannes, I'm David Pleasant.
That was David Pleasant bringing us that from the DistriPress, which brought together the world's press distribution organisation in Cannes. To wrap up this special edition of the programme, we're going to hear from Donna Hay, food writer, author, broadcaster, and of course, editor-in-chief of the eponymous Donna Hay magazine. Launched in 2001, this magazine was a precursor to dozens of food and home titles that have followed. With subscribers in over 80 countries and 730,000 readers, Donaghey's recipes and influence is spreading far beyond her Australian homeland. Tyler Brulé caught up with Donna when she was in London with her new book, Donaghey, The New Classics, in tow. They began by discussing how her magazine career started.
You go independent. You launch your own brand in a market which maybe wasn't as crowded as it is today in Australia, even though, of course, some favourite magazines have also disappeared in Australia. How did you do it? How did you set up your own shingle?
Oh, my goodness. So naive. So didn't know what I was doing, put my head down
and
just had a go. It was crazy. It was so crazy. And yeah, I think I had 9 weeks to get the first issue out.
Mm.
I really just put my head down and panicked. And I guess when you're 31, it's probably the best time to do it because you're so oblivious to what could go wrong. And I was just, oh my goodness.
Now, for the funding, did you go to a big media company? Did you go to ANZ Bank? I mean, how did it all come about?
No, after the sand dune
after
story.
After the Rajasthan.
Yeah, after the Rajasthan block.
Yeah.
Which ruined my life. I started to very arrogantly, as a 30-year-old, make up my own magazine on my studio wall. So I had my own daylight studio back then.
Everyone has to have playtime, though.
Yeah. So I was kind of, you know, like, well, if I had a magazine, this is what it would look like. So I started to make up a magazine on the wall, and people started to find out about it. And so, that's how I got two offers really quickly. I was meant to join Martha Stewart's team in New York, and I flew home to make my decision, and Lachlan Murdoch made me an offer for the magazine, and that's where it started.
And where it continues, I gather, as well.
Absolutely.
When you look at the state of media today, because obviously you are a property which doesn't just exist in print, but yet, if I think about the brand, it's still a paper brand.
Yeah, absolutely. Still a paper brand. Still books, still magazines. And, you know, the transition into digital is interesting, but
but it's just that.
Yeah, it's a transition. And,
and we're still in it.
Yeah, we're still in it. It seems long. For someone who gets bored really quickly, the transition's very long.
Well, you get bored and you just think, you know what, might as well continue doing what we're doing.
Yeah, exactly.
If I and I can think back maybe a year and a half ago, Martha was sitting in your seat and I've been very rude, or my colleague's been rude, because she had a glass of Krug last time she was here when she was in the studio. You don't. If you want one, we'll try to find one. But
fine.
Just where are the barriers for your business, though? Because you're in many markets, and of course you have a huge following here, and the magazine does well on import and import in many other markets as well. But do you have a pretty confined view or defined view when you think back to that wall when you started conceiving this, knowing it might have extensions and you might work with other brands, etc.? Do you know how elastic it is still, where you want to go with it?
I'm a really bad planner, and I just like to keep all options open. So I'm not sure how far it's going to go. I'm not sure when I'm going to get bored. I just kind of take it as it comes and just enjoy every day that's fun and crazy in my office.
Just before we go, when you look back across that great studio and all of that natural light, is there still an intact core audience that knows exactly what you're doing and have been with you on that journey?
Yeah, absolutely. My food director's been with me for 11 years. My managing editor just left for New York 7 years. We're a really tight team. We muck around a lot as creative teams too. And I still have a really active role within the team. Like, it's my job to mix the drinks on Friday afternoon. And we have really strict rules about how we work. We work 9 till 5:30 really intensely, and then everyone's kicked out. Because I believe if my team's going to deliver the most creative product for me, is they need to have a life outside the office. So we work like maniacs during that time, and then I kick them all out.
Great. I hope no one from my staff is listening.
So sorry.
Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, there, talking to Donaghey. And that is just about all we have time for on this special Best of 2014 episode of The Stack. The show was produced by David Pleasant, edited, as always, by Claire Urban, and I've been your host, Tom Edwards. If you have any comments or queries about this show or anything from 2014, drop us a note at info@monocle.com. And don't forget to tune in again next Saturday at the very same time. You can always listen again via monocle.com, iTunes or SoundCloud. So for now, until next time, it's goodbye and a very happy 2015 to all of you.